Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
We are so excited to be here with our good friend, Stephen Totillo.
Welcome back.
Welcome back.
Hello.
You were so lucky because you got to go to Nintendo's hands-on event for Switch 2. Was it yesterday that you were there?
I was there. Yeah, I was there on Wednesday.
Wow. So fresh in the mind of Stephen Totillo is your hands-on impressions of Switch 2. Sounds like you got to play a lot of stuff, see the system, obviously. So we wanted to pick your brain about like everything you saw, what you loved, what you didn't love, biggest surprises, all the things. So we're so happy to have you here.
I love being here and pick away.
Yeah, I guess just for starters, if you can tell us, like, what was the format of the event? What was kind of, how did they structure the day? What's everything that you got to do? We've been reading, like so many people, right, the impressions. It sounds like there was some sort of a roundtable interview. But how did Nintendo plan the day for you?
Right. You want the story behind this story.
Yes.
Always. Give us the dirt.
This will, you'll have flashbacks to things you worked on in the past, because this was an amalgamation of approaches Nintendo has taken in the past with one new twist. So what many people, you know, who are following y'all may not know is how E3 used to work with Nintendo, which is that while the public would see the E3 stage presentation that Reggie Fils-Aimé or somebody would be doing, or later they would see the pre-recorded Nintendo Direct on the Tuesday of E3 week or whatever, on the Sunday before E3 really began, when the forklifts were still loading things into the Los Angeles Convention Center, they would let a select number of media, a few dozen, maybe a little more than that, go to a special room and watch the Direct or get the news somehow in advance. And then after that, actually, if I remember correctly, I think that day, or maybe it would be a later day, also then do a round table where you would have somebody from Nintendo of America standing there with, or sitting there with, multiple people from NCL, from Nintendo's Japanese offices, talking about things. And so they did that again this time, in that we all were secretly watching the Direct, this time not in advance, but at the same time as the public, but from the secret location of this New York City venue, which is also where they're then going to be doing these public showcases that start on Friday. Shortly after that, they let people go hands-on with the system. And then after that, people gathered back together around 3 p.m. in the afternoon for the round table with three hardware developers who are the three principals. They're the three gentlemen who also had a post go up on Nintendo.com, a four-part, here's how we designed the Switch 2. So that part was all pretty familiar. Even the hands-on aspect of it, being like, you've seen a thing, now go play it, was familiar. Again, flashbacks to various E3s where I remember Mr. Iwata and Reggie on stage talk about like the Wii U. And then, okay, press, go over here out of this room, and voila, there's a bunch of Wii U set up, and then you could play them. And so this was, leave this room and voila, here are a bunch of Switch 2s. Play with. The big twist is simply that this was all prelude to the public getting their hands on it. So when they did something like this in New York for the Switch launch, which was also 2 months before the official launch of the console, they did this showcase. They let the press in, you play the system. They didn't then, 2 days later, let the public walk through that same venue, as best I can recall. Maybe you guys recall or know differently, but I don't think the public did that. So that part's different. The fact that this all sets up this like global tour of the Switch 2.
Yeah, something we've been really wondering about is who exactly is going to be at these events, because these are events that the US is doing, Europe's doing, Japan's doing.
Yeah.
And when we did the Switch event, like, we got really lucky because we had Mr. Miyamoto there, we had Mr. Aonuma, and we really got like the cream of the crop in terms of the spokespeople. It sounds like the main spokespeople at this event were those three developers from the direct.
Those are the people who spoke, but there were some faces that you would have found familiar who were also there. Mr. Kozumi, who was one of the chief architect of the original Switch. I saw him there. I believe I saw Shinya Takahashi, who I believe is basically operates as the head of video game production at the company. Pretty sure I saw him there. Doug Bowser, head of Nintendo of America, obviously there, you know, who is sort of the current Reggie, if people are kind of following how all that works. So yeah, there were other luminaries, and I don't know if they did interviews. I think some interviews are still actually ongoing because they kind of have that space for a while. So we'll see who winds up talking. But in terms of who they had speaking that day, it was those three, the same folks that were also doing the article online.
And those are the three folks that were in the roundtable as well, speaking publicly about the Switch 2 hardware.
That's right. And they have an interesting background. Mr. Dota was the guy in the orange shirt. If you've seen the pictures, I don't know if people have noticed, so they pointed this out at the thing. They're color coded in how they dress to match the Switch 2.
Orange and gray, right?
I'm just now realizing that.
Yeah, that is by design, I believe. This is some deep cut costuming. Right. Okay.
Yeah, they quizzed us there. They said, "Do you know why we're dressed this way?" And somebody's like, "You're dressed like the Switch." And sure enough, that's what it is. But yeah, the developers were there, and I want to get his full name for you, so I don't want to mess this up. Let me just dig this up in a second for you. But the gentleman that I'm referring to, he was the head of technology on Legend of Zelda: Breath of the Wild and Tears of the Kingdom, and now he's the head of technology on all of the Switch 2. And that impressed me and just got me thinking about how well those games, you know, how effectively they tapped the hardware. Right, of the original Switch. I think like Tears of the Kingdom is seen as this kind of technological marvel of like, how did this system that's running on these like super old chips, Takahiro Dota is his name, how did the system running on these really old chips possibly, you know, create and render a game in such detail and with such effective functionality as Tears of the Kingdom? And I was actually really intrigued by the idea that he's now overseeing all the technology for Switch 2. Koichi Kawamoto was the main speaker. He's the person you see in the middle of a lot of these photographs. He's color-coded in his dress like the he might be the one who's in blue. So he's the left Joy-Con. And then there's Tetsuya Sasaki, who is the third. And they all, like, you know, Nintendo does this thing, right, where they have people who kind of produce the system the same way that you'll bring out people who kind of produce the hardware. Microsoft has not, I don't think, as aggressively promotes like system architects anymore. And PlayStation for a few generations now has promoted Mark Cerny as the main architect. And that's who the public kind of attaches their sort of understanding of, this is the person thinking about what this system will do technologically. Certainly Cerny for the PS4 and the PS5. And Nintendo, they seem to be showing an approach of, we have this kind of brain trust of Nintendo veterans work on this system, then we have this brain trust of Nintendo veterans kind of architect this system. And so, like, a manifestation of that was, Mr. Kawamoto was asked by Danny Pena of Gamertag Radio about the eShop and what to expect from the performance of the eShop. And Mr. Kawamoto talked about how, like, that was a real pet issue of his because he wanted it to run faster and more smoothly. And he's clearly kind of building on his experience with the original Switch, and he has an opportunity now to oversee the Switch 2. And so that becomes a priority for him. So I think that's interesting to think about how those sort of, you know, leadership possibilities and experiences go at the company. And maybe there's even like friendly competition, I guess, amongst the team and figuring out, okay, how can our system now be better than the system that you guys over here did to improve it?
Yeah, it was interesting to us to see that they were the three who were really getting trotted out, because in the past, that role of kind of overseeing a system has gone to a much more seasoned developer, you know, seasoned in terms of, you know, their work at Nintendo, but also kind of comfort level of being a spokesperson, because it was Mr. Koizumi before, and then before him, it was Mr. Iguchi on some of the previous hardware. But aside from Mr. Dota, who did have a small role in promoting the previous Zelda games, the other two seem to be relative newcomers to this. So it is a big ask of them to, like, now you're the face of this system.
Yeah, host this direct, do all these interviews, be in front of people, be in front of media. So yeah, I can see that being a bit of a change from their day to day. Yes, I think so. Yeah,
they were amiable and seemed very human. I mean, Nintendo has, and you know, I don't know how you all have experienced it in your capacities formerly at Nintendo. Certainly as a journalist, I experienced, you know, the warmth of Nintendo and the friendliness of their, you know, of their creators and of the, you know, how, you know, sort of cozy and happy their games are and how thoughtful their developers are when you chat with them. But then I've also experienced the, you know, stoicism or sternness of Nintendo, you know, when you're trying to cover a lawsuit they've been, you know, where they're suing somebody or they're, I'm trying to get an interview and I can't get an interview or something like that. And they're very, you know, like, well, we're Nintendo, basically, why do we have to do that? And so you kind of have that in kind of the dynamic around the company that I think gamers experience as well, where it's like, we love this company because of how happy they make us with their games, but we also get stressed and maybe angry at this company because they operate as such this behemoth of business. And so I always find it kind of reassuring, maybe reaffirming my feelings about human nature, that ultimately we're all, like, you know, jokey, friendly people with normal, like, sort of personalities or whatever and what have you. And so it was very humanizing to see these three guys up there talking about what, you know, wanting to make the, you know, this eShop better because, you know, how they felt about, you know, it before, or laughing with each other about getting obsessed about some feature or making fun of each other that they're about to go into too long an answer about some topic. And they just, you know, so there's a warmth and it was a nice chemistry amongst the crew.
For sure. I think that is the best part of some of these events that they don't have very often. It's for, you know, big reveals like new hardware, where you do get a chance to get a little bit more of that humanized personal view of Nintendo through the developers. And we always, you know, enjoyed that view into the company as well. And they've been so sort of cagey about that stuff lately that you haven't gotten a chance to see the developers face to face or in person for a long time. So this is a great opportunity to introduce some newer people to the mix. That said, what would you say was like the general mood at the event? You know, Nintendo obviously came off the big direct, and then there was obviously a lot of conversation around pricing and things like that. So a bit of an up and down in terms of the day, but what would you say was like the mood during the event?
I wasn't like people losing their minds. It wasn't like despair either. It was pretty even keeled. I would say one of the more memorable moments is when during the direct, we all were collectively watching game announcement after game announcement when they announced the Nintendo Switch 2 System Tour game and showed what essentially looked like what you would think would be a packaging tutorial kind of game akin to Astro's Playroom on the PlayStation 5, right? And then they said it was going to be a paid game. There was laughter throughout the room. So that was one reaction that gave you a little bit of a sense of things. But I mean, for me, it was because it was reporters coming in from all around the country and in some cases from out of the country. So for me, it was also like the event was very much colored by, in a positive way, seeing faces of people I hadn't seen in a while. Yes, I'll run into people at GDC or I'll run into people at DICE or even Summer Games Fest, but it's just a different. And it's still, even though we're a few years away from the most intense COVID lockdowns, it still doesn't feel like we're in a normal rhythm of sort of seeing people. So I'm seeing people I used to work with and what have you. And in that regard, it was nice to, you know, just to get together with folks. You know, people were playing the games and they were keeping busy. They gave people a lot of playing time. So the event started with, you know, you had to be there around 7 a.m. The direct began airing, or 7:30, I think. The direct began at 9 a.m., obviously ended around 10, and you could play until 6 p.m. So 8 hours of time, if you went to the round table or went upstairs to have the free lunch, you weren't playing necessarily as long, but you get a lot of time in. So people were keeping busy going from system to system and, you know, trying things out.
And in terms of the gameplay, did they have you going on a prescribed order, or was it just, we're going to turn you loose and you can go see whatever you want?
Bit of both. You started at Mario Kart, you ended at Donkey Kong. In between, you had more choice in between. So they brought us through. Initially, we came into an area. They have, and again, to be clear, this is the same venue that they're going to do the public showcase. So in some ways, I think we were also kind of a dry run for what the public is going to experience in New York. Also in Paris simultaneously, I believe there'll be these events throughout this weekend, and then it'll be going to Los Angeles and elsewhere. So you have a lot of people, the majority of people that you see, I was seeing at this event, and I think the public will see, are people in red Nintendo Switch themed shirts. They are people that are there as demoists to showcase things. They're standing next to any of the dozens, probably more than 100 TVs that are set up in various rooms that you can go to that have Switch 2s set up, some with classic, with the Pro Controller, some in the handheld mode. And these folks, the most distinct thing about them is that every time you walk into the next room, at least a few of them, they got nothing to do but clap for you. And so you go in and you're being applauded as you enter the room and the people are cheering for you like, yeah,
what so do I do? Weird.
It's like this interesting vibe that was there. So they first brought us down though to play Mario Kart World, the new open world Mario Kart game. And so I played that in Grand Prix mode on both the TV and then the handheld. So that's that was the first experience.
Thoughts on that game?
I mean, how do you mess up Mario Kart? Have they ever messed up Mario Kart? I don't know. Was Double Dash good? That's the only one I don't.
Oh.
Steven, how dare
people
you?
People are furious right now.
I don't think.
Play it. I don't know. I was not.
I mean, some of them don't hold up as well nowadays, but in the moment, I think they were all the Mario Karts have been very good right. and fun. So
right, right.
But this one, obviously, the scope is so big. You described it yourself as an open world,
yes.
you know, Mario Kart game. So like, give us a sense of the scope and what makes this feel like so much bigger than 8 Deluxe.
Yeah, were they giving you any information of, it would take this long to drive from one point to the other?
No, I should have tried that, right? I should have just tried driving. I mean, for I guess the basic way to think about it is imagine any Mario Kart game you've played before, and what if all those tracks were on one huge map and you could drive across this map and encounter and drive into any of these tracks? So it's not clear yet how much open world kind of discoverability there's going to be. Are you going to be able to drive around and just like discover tracks that you didn't know existed, you know, hidden things and whatnot? I don't know. Will there be characters to talk to? I don't know. But what we did in Grand Prix was kind of started in a race. They said, oh, you're driving to the race. I didn't really kind of grasp that. It became more clear when I played the tournament, the elimination knockout mode. So I'll describe that one more because I think I can do a better job on that one. 24 racers is the maximum number of race cars as far as we know so far. And this particular mode I played, Knockout, is for 24 players. So they had all these systems kind of hooked up to each other. Before you start, you're in this free drive mode where you can be anywhere. And this was one of the things that sold me on this idea of how vast the game world is, because I'm standing at one television with a Switch 2, and there's two or three TVs to my left with other people playing. And we're ostensibly all in the same session of the game. But I'm driving around in a swamp. The person to my left is driving around some sort of like spooky castle at night. Person to their left is in some snowy place driving over the snow. Different biomes, different terrains, whatever you want to call it. But we're all in the same session. Also, by the way, during free drive, you can rewind if you don't like how you made a turn. I asked what effect that has on other players, because I assume the whole game isn't rewinding. And will the person see me just driving backwards? The demoist wasn't sure, so I don't know. In that case, all the players are voting on which Grand Prix or sequence of tracks you're going to then do this knockout mode in. Took a while, I guess, maybe connection issues or whatever, for it to finally lock into the session. But free drive ended, and we all then queued up. So then we have 24 race cars. People have probably seen from the footage. You guys have seen. There's tons of different characters you can choose from, including a cow.
different costumes too, right?
Who else?
Different costumes that they can be in as well.
Yes, tons of costumes, different tracks. I played as Pauline from nice. You know, Super Mario Odyssey and Donkey Kong before that. And start as 24, and they tell you there's going to be a checkpoint where they're going to eliminate 21 through 24. So there's going to be 20 racers left. I think that every checkpoint was at the end of each race, and so we were doing, I think, 5 sequential races again. It's all stitched together. So you're never leaving into a menu. So you're just driving as fast as you can to the first one. And 4 people get knocked out and everybody else keeps driving. I made it till I think the final 12 or maybe the final 8. And I think I made it to the final 8, but I was 12th in that. So I was knocked out. And I was not part of the final 8 going through it. But it's like the roads are wider because they're full of so many more cars. There's so many more characters. There's so much more item chaos happening. Blue shells, red shells, giant mushrooms. It's just kind of supersized in that way. You can see so far because they can draw the graphics at a really great distance. You're seeing so many callbacks to Mario, you know, sort of elements. I saw a Goomba bouncing around in the shoe I always want to say Haribo shoe, but that's the gummy
Karubo
frog,
shoe. Yeah. not a gummy bear. Yes. Not a gummy shoe. No.
I saw the football guys from Super Mario World.
Yeah.
Charge and Chuck.
Charge and Chuck. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I, you know, you're going through, and I'm sure there are tons of deep cuts and Mario lore. And so it's exciting to me as somebody who loves open world games. I've never gotten tired of the Ubisoft formula. You know, I'm not hoping that there's a peak I can climb to defog the map in Mario World, but I wouldn't hate it if there was in Mario Kart World. I'm very interested in seeing kind of what they do out of having an open world. But if nothing else, they let you stitch these races together into these supersized races. Mm-hmm. And so everything is just, it was super fun and not a good idea necessarily to be in first place, as I learned.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. WATER to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Kind of the Mario Kart pitfall. Don't be in the lead because you'll soon be last.
Yeah. The rubber banding, as they say, Mario Kart. What other games did you find to be like surprising or really impressive that you got a chance to play?
My favorite game of the show was Donkey Kong Bonanza,
mm-hmm. Yes.
which I believe is going to cause a mass confusion of how you spell the word Bonanza because
it's
Bonanza.
That already happened to me yesterday.
You said
yeah.
It wrong.
Like, wait a minute.
B-A-N-A-Z-A.
Bonanza?
Yeah.
Gwen Stefani.
There we go.
Because, I mean, it looks right. It looks right with the A, but obviously they're going for a banana thing in there. So yeah. I thought it was, you know, you thought I said sacrilege before. I'm going to say even more sacrilege in a moment, so get ready. I thought this was, when I saw the direct, that it was simply going to be a 3D Donkey Kong platformer. And I actively dislike Donkey Kong 64.
Oh, well, there may be a few more people out there who agree with you on that one.
Wow.
So
hot takes today, Steven. Okay.
So my reaction to that one was, first of all, it was like, well, it's interesting they're doing one of these the first time in a long time. And then my second one was, okay, but why? Because one of the issues I had with Donkey Kong 64 was that not only was it kind of a tedious collectathon, because yes, you could be different apes, but you had to be each one to collect the different colored bananas, and there was way too many things to collect. But also, it didn't really distinguish itself that much from Banjo-Kazooie, to say nothing of Super Mario 64, and you had this abundance of 3D platformers. So I'm watching the Direct. I don't know how you all were feeling. You're thinking a 3D Mario game is going to come up maybe? And then yeah. 3D Donkey Kong comes out, and it looked like exciting. But initially, immediately I thought, okay, but what is Where's a 3D Mario? Donkey Kong, and how is that different than a 3D Mario? And happily, I found out when I played the game, and I was amazed by what the game actually is, and thought it was terrific. And it's by far the thing I'm the most excited about. Did you guys go through that same journey at all with me? I mean, I'll talk about what it was like once I played it. But did you guys were excited, or were you or what?
Yeah, kind of. I definitely, when I saw like sort of they did a pan in the very beginning that looked like just kind of like overworlds, and I initially thought it was a 3D Mario game because the environments looked very Mario-esque. I still really like, you know, Donkey Kong. I'm excited about a 3D Donkey Kong game, but I was also very curious about the gameplay and how it makes it feel distinct from, you know, Mario platformer. And from the trailer, and you can tell us with your hands-on impressions, but it did seem like this sort of like destroying, digging, interacting with all the things in the world, like picking up a rock and just chucking it, you know, that kind of Donkey Kong strength was on full display. So maybe that is what feels really good and makes it feel distinctive. But, you know, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you're you were very perceptive, Krista, and you sort of figured it out maybe better than I did from first impressions. Once I was playing it, I sort of got it, right? This is not simply a platformer. It's a systems-driven game, and it can be very exciting when a game is in the hands of a very skilled developer to see what they do with something that starts as kind of a basic system, and then you can kind of layer things on top of that, right? And so in this case, the system appears to be all tied to the destruction, the destructibility of the environment. I started as Donkey Kong in a mineshaft, and I'm being asked by the little Kongs to go do things. I immediately ignored them as I learned that my ability was to punch walls, so I just punched the wall next to me. And then I realized that it sort of took a big chunk out of the wall, so I punched it again and took another chunk. And I was like, wait a minute, I can just break through the side of the wall, and how far can I keep going? And I was finding kind of hidden pieces of gold as I went, and treasure chests. And I'm like, oh my God, they've stuffed what normally would just be, I think, in any 3D platform, what we would imagine would be the sort of out of bounds physical mass of the boundaries of the world. They've stuffed that with discoverable loot, because you can actually punch your way into the walls. Then I got, I was tutorialized into learning about a kind of ground punch that digs under, you know, creates a depression under you, a crater. And the same thing happened all over again. So, okay, that was kind of cool, but I'm in a mine level. So I'm like, okay, this is just how they're teaching me. They want me to know I can punch things by surrounding me with rock in this enclosed space. Okay, whatever. I go to a second area. It's like this big floating island. And there's like some rocky hills nearby and stuff like that. And again, I kind of ignore what the game is telling me to do. And I just start punching around. And soon enough, I'm just punching into the ground. And the camera is kind of zooming out a little bit. And it's showing almost what it looks like when you accidentally clip through the bottom of a game world, where you can kind of see like the, you know, the emptiness of the universe below the game level. So I feel like, am I about to like poke through the ground of this game? Like, what is happening? And I realize it's just they're playing with like the transparency so that I can still see my character, even though my vision should be occluded by like the ground, which would be in the way, where camera's here, the ground's here, I'm here. So they're going to make the ground invisible. I keep digging down, and suddenly I'm in this like cave, and there's all this stuff in it, and there's like fossils so to find, cool. And there's like bombs to like bomb rocks to throw around. And it's like, they knew I was going to go down here.
And amazing game design.
I'm wrapping my head around this idea that, oh, this game is all about being able to destroy the levels that you're in. And there are boundaries. You eventually dig enough down to the side, you clang into metal. And so you're like, okay, there's like a metal box around the level. But when I hit the map button in the second area that I was in, that was this floating island, I zoomed out. Essentially, the level looked like this layer cake of you know, a terrain for me to dig through. And there was a very conspicuous option to reset terrain, which signaled to me that they anticipate that players are going to try to destroy everything they can, maybe to the point of destroying some, you know, staircase you needed to get to the next thing. That was initially what wowed me. Then something I didn't fully grasp was the demo was telling me that, oh, you should look at your targeting reticule for when he's throwing stuff. And you're going to see something about what you're throwing at. I didn't fully get that. And then I was watching the Nintendo Treehouse showcase today, and they showed how, you know, kind of, they slowed it down a bit, and you could see that it's telling you the type of material that you're pointing at. You're pointing at dirt, you're pointing at mud, you're pointing at rock. And so there's a whole kind of interaction system of materials that you're carrying something like a heavy rock. Okay, throw it, and it's going to actually destroy the thing you're throwing it at versus something soft. And again, like this idea of this systems-based game, playing with the physicality of the objects and the environment and all that, to me is very exciting because, you know, Tears of the Kingdom was essentially a systems-based game. Like, build contraptions and see what can come of it. Breath of the Wild was a systems-based game, right? Of see the interactions between flame and freezing and you know, wood and things like that, and see what comes of it. So I'm like, if that's what this game actually is, like, sign me up. I'm super excited to see it. I wish I knew who was making it. They're not.
I was just going to ask you if you got a sense of. Now I'm so, you see, you got my little radar is up because you said Koizumi-san was there, which I'm like, VAD Tokyo was there.
Was he looking over your shoulder
as you were playing Donkey Kong and taking a little some mental notes?
He might have been. I mean, I think the conventional wisdom, and conventional wisdom doesn't take us far with trying to imagine what Nintendo's up to, right? The conventional wisdom would be that the 3D Mario team is working on a 3D Mario. But clearly they could have pivoted. I was trying to imagine who it could be. Were there any telltale signs of anything? When I zoomed out on that map and I could kind of rotate the world and think about where I was going, I got a little bit of Captain Toad vibe to it, but I don't even know if the Captain Toad team is a team, let alone like
they're
I don't
also
know who
EAD
made that
Tokyo.
Team.
Yeah. That's also that's a sub team of EAD Tokyo.
Well, there you go. Hayashida's
so, right? Yeah.
Maybe I don't want like, but I have no idea. I have no idea.
And did they give you any more background on the setting of the game of Donkey Kong being in this kind of underground mining colony? Like, I'm so curious about that.
The ingot.
How did he get there? What is he doing? What is the conceit?
He's wearing
of all
like
this?
A mining
He's
outfit,
in the outfit
too. Yeah.
Are you saying this can't be canon? You're seeing lore inconsistencies?
I don't know. I'm just curious.
What's the Donkey Kong timeline? <Just kidding.
laughs> You know, I mean, the Donkey Kong timeline is one of the more controversial timelines of Nintendo, right? Because there's the question of, in the various games where you play as Donkey Kong, there are theories that in some of those games, the Kong you're playing as is actually Cranky Kong.
Cranky
right?
Kong,
right.
Yeah, I have right. heard that theory.
So I don't know. I saw somebody speculating this is a prequel and you're playing that. I don't know. Where's Lanky? I don't like Donkey Kong 64, but I do like Lanky Kong. That's the dichotomy of me.
Huh. All right.
Interesting.
I love it.
The third game that they had on Treehouse Live today was Metroid. So I assume they had a big area for that. I expect you played that?
Of course I played that. Yes, Metroid Prime 4 Beyond.
That's good because we have been feeling that game is maybe getting a little downplayed in all of the hoopla around the Switch 2. And obviously there have the Switch 2 version. So we're glad to hear that it had a prominent place.
Yeah.
Well, prominent in that it was in the room with all the other games, but it didn't have the Mario Kart entryway applause area, and it didn't have the clap for you because you're about to play Donkey Kong area. So it was in between. So was the Nintendo Switch 2 System Tour game. So was Mario Party, Jamboree TV, and Kirby Forgotten Land expansion. It's a weird game in the sense that we know it's a Switch game as well as a Switch 2 game. We haven't really seen a difference in how it performs on both. It looked great there. They were using it to, one of the kind of unusual things, I guess, about this whole experience was the extent to which Nintendo talked about specs. They were asked in their hardware roundtable how fast a processor is, and they declined to say that. We don't usually talk about those types of numbers. They said NVIDIA, which is making the chip for the Switch 2, would talk about it. They only acknowledged that they're using DLSS for, I guess, improving frame rates, right, with AI. But what they did talk about a lot that surprised me was frame rates of their games to the point where when you were playing Metroid Prime 4 Beyond, the like kind of kiosk was labeled, this is the 120 frames per second 1080p version, or this is the 4K whatever version. And so, you know, they really wanted you to know this version is doing a thing that the Switch 1 version won't do. But they're clearly hiding what this game is really about. As much as I feel like I got my head around the Donkey Kong bonanza, I mean, joke will be on me when, like, there's only two levels based on destroying things and all the other levels. Or just collecting colored bananas, just different Kongs. That again. But I really, like, I was so excited for something different from Rare, 1999, Young Me.
There's some trauma.
The wound goes deep.
There's a trauma.
But Metroid Prime 4 Beyond's demo really felt like it was the introduction of the game. You're a Samus Aran with zero energy capsules, but you get one while you're playing. You can turn into the Morph Ball. You have the Power Beam. You may have a few more abilities than you have at the beginning of Metroid Prime 1 when you were then, you know, famously kind of depowered as you're kind of knocked out by, was it Ridley or whatever is running around? I can't even remember the enemy.
Yes.
But in Beyond, in what I'm assuming is the intro, it's very much the familiar things. I'm doing my scan visor, scanning everything, which I love. I want to scan everything. I want to read about everything that's in the environment. Lock on, and then they had motion control on, so you're locking on by holding the trigger, and then you're kind of having a little bit of an aim as you use the gyro capacity of the Joy-Con controller to do that. You know, hit the button to roll into the morph ball. You have a boss battle at the end that you want to sort of circle strafe, hit the weak points, and defeat missiles that you can shoot. Zero of anything you haven't done before in a Metroid Prime game, and then Psylocke or whatever his name is, he shows up at the end looking tough, and this device that I think when I scanned it said, you know, we recovered this from some mystery planet or whatever, we don't know what it is. I think he shoots it and it blows up, and that's like the screen goes to white. And I'm thinking, A, this is the moment where you then become depowered and the game actually begins, or this is the moment where you figure out, oh, this is what the game is actually about. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you all, but when I saw the Direct last week and they said that Samus Aran gains psychic powers that allow her to open doors. I thought that cannot possibly be the hook for this game.
Yeah. I had the same impression as you, actually. When I saw the game last week in the Switch 1 Direct, and we saw it again for a little bit in this Direct for Switch 2, I was just really left with more questions than I think whatever they showed me answered. And I was a little bit like, tell me more about the psychic powers, because right now I don't quite understand how that works in with all the rest of the gameplay.
Right.
Interesting that you kind of got that sense even playing the game that it was very sort of intro, like you're not really learning what is the new hook for the game in this moment. We've been feeling a little bit like, gosh, it feels like this game has this kind of is sitting at this little, like a little bit of a danger zone of like, could it be forgotten a little bit in the rest of the Switch 2 lineup stuff? Unfortunate if so, because we've all been waiting for this game for a super long time. And if it somehow kind of gets lost in the mix, that would be unfortunate, you know?
Yeah. I read one theory after people watched somebody reacting to the trailer of last week that the gimmick could be time travel.
They
picked this up from just some of the marketing language around it, where they were like, you know, this so like, when I don't even remember what the verbiage is, and I'm like, I have no idea. This might just be very like, you know, grasping it at the very tiniest, you know, shred of something. But you think about how Metroid Prime 2 added the idea of there being this kind of negative universe, almost like a Link to the Past type kind of flip of the world. And Metroid Prime 3 had both the motion control as kind of the addition of it, but also now multiple planets that you were going to and kind of doing a little bit of space travel and spaceship stuff in between, I think, if I remember correctly. And so I assume there's some sort of hook. I can confirm, by the way, that in this intro area, you do open doors, even though you don't have psychic powers yet. So,
wow.
You know, right, you open the doors by shooting at them. Maybe it's nicer to open doors with your mind than with a gun, like possibly. Like Samus is kind of learning a little bit about how to be like a better member of society. Maybe this game
don't
is all
destroy
about
everything, Samus. Gosh, these space stations are very expensive to rebuild.
I will say there were, by the way, in the intro, there were enemies that were kind of like, they were half defeated already. They're just kind of like slouched down like
and you're
like, the game's like, just go zap them.
Like, it's like an old Yeller kind of moment. They're rabies. You gotta get rid of them.
Maybe that's what it was.
How did they
introduce the controls for the game at this demo? Did they start you with the mouse? Did they give you a choice of what you wanted to start with?
They handed me the controllers, which had to, I'm trying to remember now. They were the Joy-Con controllers separated. And let me play. And I think at one point they said, you know, you can do mouse control. And the kind of magic moment, and this was probably the most magical moment in terms of anything related to the interface of the Switch, of the entire event, of the Switch 2, excuse me, was that you're just holding the Joy-Con and you put it down on the table. It's immediately in mouse mode. There's no button press to trigger it. There's nothing. Later on, Bryant Francis from Game Developer asked the hardware folks in the round table about, how does that work? They talk more about how it's an option. And I later talked to the Hogwarts Legacy people who also said in the Direct that they were going to allow mouse control. And they told me, yes, in our game, it is a menu option. So the hardware devs were saying it can be something you pause the game to activate, but it can also be automated. But they didn't explain exactly how it was done. I mean, we can guess that the gyro might have known that I was turning the point down.
The infrared or something.
The infrared sensor may have known it was now against the surface.
Right, now you're on a surface, yeah.
And so once I had it there, in theory, I could use that like a mouse to do my aiming. And I know a lot of people are very excited about this idea of mouse control and FPS, and they like motion control. I've never been that partial to it for the Metroid Prime games, because to me, those games have always been more detective and archaeology style games. To me, it's not about, like, Samus is a bounty hunter. Of course she can shoot her targets. Like, she's like great at what she does. Like, to me, the fiction of that game and kind of the interactivity that makes sense for it is that she can lock onto everything to scan it, understand it, defeat it, whatever the case may be, and then use her wits via me, the player, to switch to the beam needed or the visor needed or something like that. And so the idea that Samus might even miss her targets is like an idea that, yes, maybe that is true to the 2D games, didn't feel like it was baked into the core of how the games. And again, this may be as weird a theory or as my antipathy for Donkey Kong 64. I have all these strange opinions. But you can apparently turn off the gyro controls and you can do a more traditional, old school lock onto it as well. But that the challenge kit with the motion control, the mouse control rather, is all the demos, all of them were standing up. I know a lot of people are into like standing desks and stuff like that, but I don't actually don't know if people who use standing desks tend to game mouse and keyboard standing.
Right.
I feel like people are mostly like in their chairs, right? When they're doing mouse and keyboard. And so there's
if you're a PC gamer, I think you're probably sitting down and gaming.
Right.
I am very concerned about this, honestly, because I'm not like a PC gamer really. And right. I like to sit on my couch when I play games like a normal person.
So to what extent did they let you say, like, well, let me try this on my leg here. Or let me try it on my arm. Like, to what extent were they open to you testing
totally,
the functionality?
Totally fine. They were actually overall very chill about the handling of the hardware. And I'll get to that, but I want to just be very clear about the point I was making about the table for this particular demo. And then I want to elaborate also on Chris's concern. The problem was I was standing, and so my hand had to kind of be like this with my elbow high because of where the table was at. And then trying to move a mouse around that way didn't feel as good as like usually your elbow would be lower, I think, or level with your hand if you're using a mouse. So my experience using the mouse controls on Metroid Prime was quite poor, in part, I think, because I had this like carpal tunnel in waiting kind of posture. The other problem with it is that when you hold the Joy-Con on its edge, the face buttons are on the side. Nicely, the shoulder buttons, and people can sort of play around with this with their own Joy-Cons for Switch 1. Put that thing on its side, and your pointer finger and your middle finger will quite naturally land on the bumper and the ZR or ZL, whichever hand you're using. And you can imagine those as a mouse, left mouse, right mouse button, right? Those work nicely. But the Metroid Prime controls still wanted me to hit X for the Samus scan visor. And so now picture, and again, you can do this, just take out your right Joy-Con controller, you know, and try it. And then try to not just hit the X button, but remember, you have no muscle memory for this. Maybe after you do this a bunch of times, you will attain it. But this is not a posture
or a
gesture, I guess, that we've done as gamers with our Switch controllers at all. When I played Civ 7, which also uses the mouse controllers, they were more about put your two fingers on the shoulder and ZR buttons, use it as a mouse, but then put your thumb on the analog stick, which is sticking right out. Actually, that was very comfortable. And I think I was using that maybe for zoom in, zoom out on the camera. And they said, oh, don't worry. In the final version, we'll also have things mapped to every button, including Y for skip and turn. And I was thinking to myself, no,
complicated.
but the left Switch controllers, I want to say sometimes the left one was plugged in at some of the kiosks. I don't even remember if both left and right were always plugged in. They may have been. But I play a drag and drive, which people may think of as drag X drive because of how it's spelled. And this is the wheelchair basketball game.
Yeah.
The main kind of showcase of the mouse control. And for that one, before the game even said it, I was like, I don't know about using the table. I'm going to try my legs. And it was much more comfortable just sitting there. And so, Krista, the good news for you is that it totally works with the legs. And you can just play, you know, on the leg my cat wasn't there, so I couldn't try it on my cat's back. That could be mutual. And cat might like that at the same time.
You're like petting your cat playing drag and drive.
All right.
I can get down with that.
They can make a new Nintendogs where you pet.
Oh, you pet your actual dog.
Pet the actual dog. It comes with an actual dog. And you in the box and you pet the dog with the controller.
I tried briefly.
I was like, oh, could I do it on my chest? Like, you can, like it's, I think it's just detecting that it's against the surface.
Against any surface. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. If you look at the packaging peripheral stuff, whatever that comes with the Switch 2, it includes, what's it called? The Joy-Con grip? Is that what it's called on the Switch 1?
The one that makes it look like a little doggy with a little thing in the back.
I never thought of it that way, but yes. Yeah, it's like the extra black edge to the thing, right?
Yeah.
Which prevents you from locking the controllers back on the system, but when you turn it sideways, makes it easier to hit ZL, ZR, right?
Those are the rails. Those are called rails.
Yeah.
Yes.
The rails.
That's something different. Yes.
Oh, the Joy-Con. Oh, now I know why you said it looks like a dog. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Definitely not Joy-Con grip. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
I totally got it. Yes, it does look like a dog. Yes. Never saw that. Now I can't unsee that in my mind. I love that. The rails. That's what it's called.
Maybe. Yes.
They want to charge you extra for those too. It's like $14.
So I believe they come packaged with the Switch 2. If I'm misspeaking, I'm sure somebody can figure that out, but I believe they come with it. and they get attached to there. And the function of those for the Switch 1 was that those two shoulder buttons, which I just called ZLZR, but they're not. What were they called?
SL.
SL and SR.
SR, right? Yes. Yeah.
Those were like depressed in and very hard
right.
to get
hard
to.
Hard to push, right.
So you put the rails on them, and then suddenly those buttons were raised because the rails raised them. You wouldn't think you would need that at all with the Joy-Con for Switch 2 because there's just like those buttons are not as depressed in SLSR. That said, the new rail, which I don't even know if they would call it a rail, and it's more like an oval that goes around that thin edge of the Joy-Con, of that inside edge, and it has I think are pads at both ends of it. That becomes a smoother surface to rub mouse control. So I didn't think of this until the end, and I certainly wasn't given the permission to take the thing off or put it on or whatever and compare. But my guess is that on a hard surface table, using mouse control may feel a bit rougher, rougher, like you're scuffing either your controller or your table. And then you put this thing on, and then you get more of it's like a portable mouse.
It's like an Apple mouse where it has the little rubber bits on the bottom so that when you're on a surface, it doesn't feel it's scratching your table or whatever.
There you go. So yeah, you can use your leg, which, that's itself obviously generally a softer surface than a table,
right?
To do that. And so it works, but it's the most divisive thing that I've seen in terms of reactions. Ash Parrish, my former Kotaku colleague who now writes for The Verge, wrote a piece today critical of the mouse controls, saying she just didn't like the feel of them.
Did it feel like a gimmick to you? Did it feel like feel the Joy-Con ice cubes like that, or was it more functional, would you say?
Are you talking about the HD Rumble stuff?
Yes.
Does it feel like would you want to play a whole game like that?
Yeah, I'd be fine with it. I'm skeptical of any haptic stuff because, Star Fox 64, the Rumble Pack felt good, but generally haptics are, they're okay. Yeah. But I feel like they're often kind of overhyped. Whereas the ability to just have kind of cursor control, I've never felt good about motion control, gyro control, pointer cursor stuff. And that's kind of been, a lot of people have kind of been okay with that for a couple of generations, whether it was Wii stuff or beyond. I'm picking things off a menu. I want, a mouse is always going to feel better. And so if I can just select things by, using that mouse control, and if I can flip to that as quickly, that would feel good. And, hope springs eternal about the creative renaissance that Nintendo had with the DS. And when they started making stylus driven games, and it opened up new categories of design for them, that the company kind of revisiting the idea of a mouse, which they pointed out, hey, we made one for Mario Paint back on the Super Nintendo. Then revisiting making a mouse could augur in, a wave of new ideas from them that involve, things that we would use pointer controls for, or even, heaven forbid, something, drawing based again, or, but a shorter answer is please, yes, bring on WarioWare Mouse.
There we go.
Oh, I would love that.
Hopefully that's already being worked on.
That's basically like the DS WarioWare experience, Touch WarioWare Touch. If they had a WarioWare Mouse version, that would be amazing.
Right. I mean, WarioWare's have been great showcases of touch rotation control on WarioWare Twisted, right? Something that wasn't even native to a specific platform, but to that cartridge, or motion control more recently. I really trust those WarioWare teams to take an interface concept and do some fantastic things with it. So I would love to see them do that.
Yeah.
Well, we have to ask, because it's become one of the overwhelming conversation points about the Switch 2. What discussions were you having with the people at this event about the pricing information as it was rolling out?
Right. So the event ends, and it was weird they didn't announce the price because you thought that was going to possibly be the final thing that they said. Then the press release hit. So I'm still sitting there, and I was trying to file in real time. Okay, this event ends, and my goal with my game file newsletter is that if I'm at an event like this, I'm writing while it's happening. Pretty much I just have to do one more scan of it, and I hit send. And I was like, oh, they didn't say the price. Let me just double check. The press release comes in, and it says right at the top, introducing Switch 2 June 5th for $449.99. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting that they didn't announce it there, but they said it here. That tells you something about what they thought the impact of communicating that would be. I'm curious actually what you all think in terms of that strategy, but that was the first wave of it. And then it was, what do they, the game's cost. But just staying on the hardware, in your both of your experiences, what did that tell you that they did not put it in the direct? But that
they definitely were concerned about that. They clocked early that this might be a point of, you know, contention for people. And with the direct, they were very focused on, like, in their Nintendo way of, let's make sure that people are staying focused on the experiences. People are staying focused on how amazing these games look. Let's not distract them from that with price. But I think it actually, unfortunately, had a bit of a negative, more of a negative effect than they had anticipated. So.
I mean, if you have a, Chris, if you have a piece of information that you know people are going to want to know, and you don't put it in your video showcase that millions of people are watching, but you immediately have it in your press release that comes right out after that, that's going to result in coverage that maybe the same amount of people are going to read. Have you effectively hidden it from anybody
fooling anybody? It's not an effective communication strategy. And in fact, it caused more confusion. So
the whole communication strategy about the whole, the pricing of everything for the Switch 2 is very curious to us, because there were some things that were obfuscated in a press release. There's some details that we still don't know about today. And nobody from Nintendo seems to be getting out there openly talking about anything,
right?
Which just makes it even more confusing. Like we before we started recording, we were talking about this strange rumor of Mario Kart being $90.
Physical Mario Kart.
And it's like, where did this come from?
They've just lost control
of this.
They have. And the live chat in the YouTube stream of the Nintendo Direct, as I saw you
on social media,
drop the price, with the occasional trolling, raise the price, you know, thrown in there.
At the event itself, though, when you finally got the press release and realized the price was, you know, in there and not the direct, what was sort of the mood, and was there other discussion around you around?
A lot of people had kind of drifted off to other things. Jason Schreier, you know, good friend of mine, former colleague, and now doing a great job covering games at Bloomberg with Cecilia D'Anastasio. Jason was there, and I was saying to him, did they say anything about the game price? The game price, because I'm seeing the hardware price. I need to send out my newsletter. You know, I want to have my news out. I want to send it out. You know, it's an email newsletter, and you can read it online, but I can't take it back. I can't easily update it. I want to make sure that I've got it right, and I'm sending something out that's useful to people. And so I had originally written it as they didn't, you know, I had like bullet points for hardware price, not, they didn't say anything, software price, they didn't say anything. And then I'm suddenly seeing, you know, again, as the thing ends, they've announced the hardware price. So he's kind of come and gone and everything. I'm like, Jason, did they say anything? Are you seeing anything about game prices? And he's like, oh, and then he's like, I just texted you. I'm like, what? And then I check and he just found a screenshot of Mario Kart $79.99. And I'm like, where did you see that? Because I'm looking at the press release. It's not in the press release. But it's on Nintendo.com.
Website,
go through the Mario Kart World page and you wait for all of the weird widgets to load and everything is moving. Look at this feature. That like was it like the last minute attempt to distract people? Like, oh, this stuff.
Yeah, I think it was.
and then you see, oh, the price is right there. And so then, of course, it's like, oh my God, are all the games going to cost $80? Because for better or worse, that game did not appear in the direct to be like, obviously more grand than Donkey Kong or Metroid or something. So there was nothing inherently obvious of like, oh, well, they're charging $80 because that's the game that they just said is going to contain, you know, every Mario Kart track of all time or something like that, right? Like there's nothing like that was screaming that this is beyond the standard, you know, impressive new game. And so I then, you know, I think I've sent my newsletter by then without the $80. I think I sent it just without the game prices. So I immediately put an update in there. But then of course, like, and thankfully I had the discipline to not say, well, this is what every game's going to cost. And I just said, this is what Mario Kart appears to cost. Cause then very quickly after that, he and I think figured out that, oh no, I was, the Canadian Broadcasting Company was there. They wanted to have me talk about Switch 2 for them. And so I was in the room waiting for my turn to do an interview there with them. And I'm looking it up and I saw that Donkey Kong Bonanza was selling for listed on the Nintendo site as $69.99. So it's this thing. Now, this is not an unusual phenomenon, this kind of figuring out the information as the event goes along. I'll take you back about a decade ago to Microsoft's notorious Xbox One TV games event this is known as sort of the most disastrous rollout of a new console of all time, where they announced a lot of things that now are kind of similar to some of the things Nintendo's doing with the digital game card, but it was a lot about limitations on game sharing. But the real dramatic one was that the physical games needed to be connected to the internet. You know, if you had a disc game, you couldn't easily just hand a game to somebody else, which led to the whole, you know, PlayStation snarking on them at the E3 following with, here's how you share games on PlayStation. You just hand them to each other. And sorry for the digression to a digression to a digression.
I'm sure Nintendo will love that you're comparing that event to theirs.
the thing that happened at that event was, which is vivid in my mind, is that I had an interview with Phil Harrison, who at the time was a Microsoft executive. And this was like hours after Don Matrick had gone and done this whole thing and sort of revealed some aspects of this, you know, trying to put a positive spin on this idea that it's very much a TV watching box and everything, and an entertainment box beyond a games box. And then I'm interviewing Phil Harrison, and while I'm talking to him, I'm like, so you're going to have this discs go in the thing, and then how often do they have to check? And I forget what he told me it was at this point. I forget if he said every 30 days or every day or whatever he said. I really can't remember. I should, because it was my scoop. And so then I'm like, I'm walking out of the room to be ferried to my next, you know, appointment where I'm going to be put in like the soundproof room to see how Microsoft records audio for games or something. And I'm like texting or emailing Jason or somebody else from Kotaku at the time, being like, I can't believe he just told me this. And so that becomes a new piece of information, and we're updating our articles on Kotaku at the time, and you're finding this stuff out bit by bit. And then like I come out of that room for the next appointment, and I've got a Microsoft PR person intercepting me saying, well, we want to tell you a little more. And so like what's enjoyable about that is that it gets a little bit closer to what like real reporting is, which is like you're constantly finding things out,
developing story.
Yeah, it's a story. It's things that happen. You're not just rewriting a press release. You're trying to dig or whatever. And this is not the most Pulitzer-worthy scooping. But that was a little bit of how yesterday unfolded. And frankly, like discovering that Donkey Kong cost 70 rather than 80 is one way this would diverge from that disastrous Microsoft event. Because it was like, oh, okay, they're not going to 80 for everything. They're not, you know, they've not lost their minds. You know, 70, I think, is a price people can understand Nintendo would go to for their new games, because that's what so many publishers have gone to now, whether you like it or not, whether you think this is what the industry needs to help subsidize development, whether you think that these companies make so much money you can afford to spend more, like, can debate that. But that was certainly an interesting dynamic all happening while there are all these Nintendo people around, and you go up to them. I said, you know, can you tell me anything about the pricing of the games? And, you know, the response is from PR people is, well, you can see on our website.
It says, and I'm like, keep it locked.
You got anything else? We are very scared. Please don't talk to us.
Our life is on the line.
And, nobody was giving pricing. I did not ask for the pricing on the smaller games. So I don't know what the Nintendo Switch 2 system tour, which I think
I don't think we still know.
I don't know.
As of recording this, I don't think that information is out.
Yeah. But yeah, and also I think there was some questions around the varying pricing of the Switch enhanced games. Some of them do look like, okay, this is full on new content, DLC, whatever, paid DLC. Some of them is like a little bit less than that. So what is the pricing there? And then when you finally like do the math and total that up, are you like even past $80? You
but know, also some point? Of them are just included with NSO.
And some of them
aren't.
Are included.
So it's
some
confusing.
It's very confusing the way that they have managed this pricing conversation altogether.
Oh, for sure. So they wouldn't. Nobody would tell me what any of the add-ons would cost. So I played the add-ons for Kirby and the Forgotten Land and Mario Party. And the demo was there. Didn't have anything to tell me about that. They have release dates. Like one is July and one is August, if I remember correctly.
Right. Yeah.
They're pretty
soon. But no pricing. Yeah.
Obviously, they have a lot of leeway there if these are digital add-ons in terms of what they price those at. Although, you know, it's going to be a physical game as well to some extent. They should have the pricing. They should know the pricing by now. I'd heard that the Switch Edition upgrades are supposed to be in the $10 to $20 range. Nintendo, obviously, part of this is that they don't typically drop the prices significantly, if at all, of their legacy games.
They don't,
So if they're any other publisher, their games from 2 or 3 years ago are no longer what they retailed for, and they're, you know, if they had been 70 or 60, they're 50, 40, 30, or even 20 by now. Capcom has been making, you know, record profits for the last decade with an aggressive strategy of constantly dropping price on their games. Not necessarily like super quickly so you feel burnt by it, but recognizing that there's another customer tier to reach when your game is $30, when your game is $20, when your game is, I think they've said they want to make every game eventually $10 at some point, so they can also sell in more markets around the world and places where people don't have as much income. Nintendo was like, well, we're charging you $60 all for all time. And so a $20 add-on to a Kirby game from 3 years ago makes it look like it's going to cost $80. And that's what Walmart's listing, the expanded version of Kirby and the Forgotten Land. And my takeaway on the Kirby game is I love that game. My kids and I played that game. We had the greatest time with it. I'm playing the expansion Star-Crossed World, and it did not immediately feel to me like anything more than another cool level of the game I played. It did not feel like it needed the Switch 2, is what I'm trying to say. Mm-hmm. And so in that case, you might be like, hey, if it's an expansion and maybe it's a big expansion, we might think of that as it deserves a $20 price, but you have to buy a $450 system to access it if you like the old game.
Yeah.
And my question is, are we sure that are people going to feel with some of these Switch 2 edition, you know, upgrades that, hey, a lot of this should just be added to Switch 1 and I'm being pushed into upgrading? Certainly the better frame rates on Zelda, the higher resolution graphics, that kind of thing makes sense that the newer hardware would take. And we've seen Sony charge $10 for a lot of these upgrades into the new gen systems. But I look at something like that and I'm like, it's $80 for what's essentially a 3-year-old game, or, you know, plus an expansion that feels like it's not really tapping the hardware. Maybe Star-Crossed World will eventually have aspects of it where I'm like, oh, clearly they couldn't technologically have done this on the old device, but it didn't feel that way. So I feel I'm actually more like okay in understanding of even charging $80 for a Mario Kart World, if that's going to be a game that has, like, you know, a decade of longevity to it or whatever that we Mario Kart 8 did for players, then I am okay wrapping my head around this idea of what some of these upgrades are going to cost. Because $20 on top of a $60 game you never drop price in just seems, it's like asking a lot.
Yeah.
Just as people who, you know, worked on the communication side, we've been so interested in that side of the story, and we're just going to keep an eye on it. But we know you have limited time. It's almost time for you to go. Before we wrap up, the one thing that surprised you the most that you saw at the event, of like, oh, I didn't expect to be so intrigued by this.
Well, Donkey Kong, I already said I was into, but what I was most pleasantly surprised by was the return of Weird Nintendo. So I think we've discussed this before, but I like when Nintendo gets extra quirky in terms of making things like Nintendo Labo, or they did some of the more experimental download-only games. And in recent years, particularly on the Switch, yes, Labo was on Switch, but I feel like we've seen less of this sort of small-scale experimentation within their games. We've seen grand experimentation with the, you know, the sort of revitalization of the Zelda franchise, and they've done some amazing things on a large scale. But I haven't gotten that feeling of, oh, I'm playing something made by like the Skunk Works team in Nintendo, tinkering around doing something unusual. And I felt that way. Again, I have no idea who's making Dragon Drive. I'm saying this and it may not even be made by Nintendo for all I know. But I felt that way in seeing something like Dragon Drive, which took, you know, a setting and a milieu in terms of people in wheelchairs playing basketball, and saying, you know, that fits well with this idea of dual mouse control. Who's ever played a game with two mice before? Like, I don't know. Maybe if I'd played Donkey Kong 64 with two mice, I would have liked it a lot better.
You would have a better experience.
I don't know exactly how, you know, good that game will be overall. But that Nintendo Switch Tour game really intrigued me, because it's full of these mini games that have unlockable variations. And they didn't unlock the variations. And at the very most basic, it's like, hey, answer a quiz of what frame rate you think this ball is bouncing in front of you in. And it's like, do you think this is 20 frames a second or 40? And I'm like, this is like Digital Foundry of the game. And weird, but
you cannot charge money for that. Unacceptable to me.
But what if they have some great idea about a frame rate related game?
What if? Okay, you buy it and you tell me about it, because I won't buy it unless.
What if?
So I mentioned WarioWare Twisted before, and one of my favorite things about WarioWare Twisted, which is one of my favorite games of all time, is that since the whole game is used with a rotation sensor on the Game Boy Advance, they have, you may recall, Super Mario Brothers World 1-1, and you play it by kind of rotating,
rotates around as you go through it.
Pardon me. I hit the cough button effectively on all my previous coughs.
It's okay.
I missed. In this one, they want to show off the value of having 4K graphics. Again, very un-Nintendo to be like bragging about the specs of things. And they start you off, it's very small, in the side of the screen, you see just what would be the opening screen of Super Mario Brothers 1-1. And then as you run, the screen gets wider and wider, and eventually the entire length of Super Mario Brothers 1-1 is unfurled across, as you move through it, across the screen. Now, obviously it's pretty short, right? Because to be able to fit that all, even across a pretty big size TV, you know, you have to make it pretty compressed. But there, you get to play across the whole level. And I really like that idea of kind of single screen Mario side scroller. And I'd not ever seen Nintendo dabble with that. I don't know if that game would contain all of Super Mario Brothers being able to be played that way. But could you imagine, like, let's just say, and I'm not saying they're doing this, what if you played at the top of the screen 1-1, and then below it you played 1-2?
Yeah, like a ribbon. The levels just keep going.
And that would be cool. They had all of Mario, but I don't know that they're doing that. But like, there was a Castlevania game made like over a decade ago for Xbox Live Arcade, and it was like, what if Castlevania took place on one screen? It was like a fun experiment. So I don't know like how deep or quirky the experiments get in that tour game, but I found that interesting and surprising. So
Awesome.
Well, thank you for checking in and reporting for us, since we are here on the West Coast and very much not invited to these events.
You think you can't get an interview? We can't even get invited. Come on now.
Can I throw in throw in a thought for you all and for
please.
Okay, I want people to think about the 3DS a lot. Okay, the 3DS, because there's been a lot of discourse about the Switch 2, and you know, Wii to Wii U, or I don't know, even N64 or SNES to N64 to GameCube, and sort of Nintendo going from like a peak to something lower. And I think the analogy that I was thinking about a lot when I was at the event yesterday was the phenomenon of the DS and then the 3DS as it followed. And I think it's very apt to be mindful of this when thinking about kind of where things are going with Nintendo and where things might go. The DS was one of Nintendo's most popular systems ever. It had like three lightning in a bottle games. It had Nintendogs, the virtual pet that people loved. It had Mario Kart 7, a staple, you know, traditional video game that was a hot seller. And it had brain training, turnip book style, use a stylus, make yourself and keep your mental health good. And it had tons of people buying it that normally would not have bought Nintendo hardware, right? Switch is very analogous to that. Breath of the Wild, Mario Kart Deluxe, huge selling games. Animal Crossing is the crossover game to people who didn't think they were ever going to buy a Nintendo system. How do you follow that up? Well, what happened with the DS? They had released iterative versions of the DS, DSi, DS XL, similar to the iterative versions of the Switch, right? Finally did a step up on the 3DS. That's what I think that we should think of the Switch 2 as. And what did they learn with the 3DS? They learned initially that they made it too expensive. They released it thinking people were ready for a step up to this phenomenally popular system. They struggled to bring people over. In that case, maybe they didn't have the killer game they needed to have at launch to help sort of sell people on that idea. And what did they have to do? Y'all know, several months later, the company apologized. Mr. Iwata, rest in peace, took a pay cut in the process. They created the ambassador program to reward people who had bought the system at a high price early on. And they were able to kind of right the ship so that it was a stable and strong business for them. And, you know, it wasn't as big as DS, unless you're a Nintendo shareholder. Who cares? It wasn't quite as big as DS. But it became like a healthy system, full of great creativity, probably my favorite Nintendo system ever. And so I'm curious if the Switch 2 is about to follow that same trajectory. Coming in at a price that's a bit daunting, I think its lineup feels better early on than the 3DS's lineup felt at this time. But maybe they find themselves in a spot where they have to say, you know, and to me this is like the worst case scenario. It's like, oh, well, we priced it too high. Sorry, we'll make it lower and they'll come up with some freebie for their early adopters. But I think that's the historical model to look at. Am I onto something, or should I be thinking, I don't know, Virtual Boy or?
Oh, no, let's hope not. No, I think you're definitely onto something. Anything to follow, it's just tough. You know, it's challenges. Your bar is so high when you follow something extraordinarily successful for a number of reasons, some of which were outside of your control, like a pandemic. And you have to follow it up with something else. And, you know, the world's a different place now. It's just going to be tough. So they're going to have to figure out how to do that. And, you know, step one might be them just communicating to us what right. the heck is going on. So people won't be, you know, locked in confusion and misinformation. But I do think that you're onto something in terms of that comparison.
And to that, I'll add on, Nintendo, bring on Rusty's Real Deal Baseball 2.
Oh my gosh. Yes, that's a great game.
Do you remember what you could do with the first game? You could haggle with Rusty the dog about the price of the mini in the game.
Yes.
People are ready to haggle.
Negotiate with a cartoon dog about the price of Mario Kart. It's the game we need.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Stephen, for being here with us. You're always a welcome guest anytime here. And we love reading GameFile every single day.
Please take a moment to plug GameFile because we are very happy subscribers, very happy paid subscribers. Yes, we love reading that.
Okay. And you have some great footage of you playing these games on GameFile. So I want people to go there to see actually videos of you playing the games.
That's right. GameFile is the newsletter I write at gamefile.news. You can read a free version of one of the newsletters a week. You can read the early, you know, the preview versions of others, but there's 3 to 4 newsletters a week. As much original news as I can pack in there. And in cases like my Switch 2 preview or hands-on, you can see footage of all we talked about and extra stuff as well, including me playing Wind Waker through the GameCube backwards compatibility and experiencing the snappy save states of loading right back into the action based on wherever you decide to create a save state. So there's a lot of stuff in there. I'll actually have more of Switch 2 coverage to come. So look forward to that. But certainly I'm happy for people to check it out and tell me what they think.
Awesome. We're going to leave all that in the description as well for people so you can easily click through. But yes, we are avid followers of GameFile and everything that you do. And it's been awesome to see you find so much success with.
Thanks so much.
Going independent.
Mutual appreciation. Love what you guys do.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, we'll let you go.
Until we speak again.
Thank you so much.